Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. We've recently started to talk about strategies to protect your assets, both before and after you die. And one of the areas that people are least informed about on this one in particular is superannuation. It comes as a surprise to many people that your super actually isn't part of your estate when you die, certainly not automatically, and that a person you've never met may get to decide who receives your benefit. Given that super is the average Australian's second largest asset after the family home, and for young people, it's really their largest asset, especially if they have insurance, this really matters. So to help us understand all of this complexity and how to ensure your super goes to the person or the people that you want it to go to, I'm speaking with Meg Heffron. Meg is a self-managed super fund expert and one of the founders of Heffron SMSF Solutions, an SMSF administrator. They do my fund, so I trust them implicitly. Meg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Gemma.
So Meg, one of the trickiest things for people to understand about super is that if it's paid from your fund when you die, so we're talking about death benefits now, lovely cheery topic.
So you're talking to an actuary, so that's absolutely fine. We love talking about death.
We're thinking about this stuff all the time. Yeah. Okay, so when you pass away, your super, if it is paid from your super fund, and that's a sort of technicality we'll get to in a minute, it can only go to a limited number of people. So you can tell us a bit about that.
Yes, that's right. And even though you introduced me by saying I work in SMSFs, everything we're going to talk about today actually applies to every superannuation fund. So it's really important for people to understand, no matter what fund they have, because regardless of what type of fund you have, actually the trustees of that fund are legally only allowed to pay your death benefit to either your estate or, as you said, someone in a small list of people. The technical term for that is they're defined as dependents for superannuation law, and it can actually go outside your estate or that list of people if you don't have either. So if no estate is formed when you die, or if you don't have anybody on that list of people. So the list is really important. And that list, as I said, described as dependents for superannuation law, it's broader than it sounds. It's not just the people who rely on you financially, although they're certainly included. But in this context of who can get your money, it also includes your spouse, regardless of whether they depend on you or you run your finances totally separately. And it's not just people you're married to, it's de factos, it's same-sex couples. So your spouse and your children, even if they're actually adults and wealthier than you. So when it comes to who can get the money, spouse and any child, superannuation also has this strange concept that I don't think actually appears anywhere else. I can't think of it in any other context anyway, called interdependency. There's a long-winded definition of that, but basically it might include people who are not actually a couple, but they've got some kind of shared life together that goes much deeper than just friends who share a house. My aunt has lived with the same person for 50 years. They're not a couple, but they're really good friends. They share a life. They have the same circle of friends. They look after each other when they're sick, all those kinds of things. That's the kind of thing we're looking for an interdependency relationship. Those people are also people who can have your super when you die. So it's weird, isn't it? Even though it's your money, and so you'd expect to be able to decide to give it to anyone you liked, a super fund can only actually pay it to those people or to your estate.
Okay, so what if you want to pay it to someone who's not on that list? So the one that I get most frequently is actually people wanting to pay to their parents if they are youngish, so 20s and 30s and so on. They don't have anyone else they would consider to be a dependent, but they, if their parents are not particularly well off, they'd like to ensure that their parents are taken care of in retirement if something happened to them, or it's just the person they're closest to. How would you make that happen?
Yes, and I guess in that context, you're thinking of parents where they don't depend on you financially.
No.
It's just that's where you'd like your money to go.
Yes.
So whilst the law would say the super fund can't pay it directly to them because they're not on the magic list, remember, it can also be paid to your estate.
Right.
So what you could do in that situation is get it paid to your estate. The super fund gives it to your estate, and then your executor gets the money and deals with it under your will. So if your will said, please leave my super to my parents, the executor would then give it to them, unless there was some other problem with your will, like it wasn't valid. So superannuation law just drives who the super fund is allowed to give it to directly, not who can ultimately end up having the money.
Right, okay. So if you have any scenario where you're not okay with what super law says and what the trustee can do under super law, ideally you'd get it paid to the estate and let your estate deal with it.
And make sure your will says who you want it to go to. That's right.
That's the other bit, which is very important. All right, so it's worth noting that in the scenario we're talking about, you're dead. And someone needs to decide what happens with the money. So who decides?
Yeah, good question. And I guess, again, it's easy to assume that since it's your money, you always get to decide and you can tell the trustees in advance who's going to get your money. But in fact, all super funds are trusts, and that means the default position is that the trustee decides. The law does allow you to be a bit directive. You can give the trustee of your fund a legally enforceable instruction known as a binding death benefit nomination. You do it in advance, and as long as it's done properly, they have to follow it. But if you don't do that, then the trustees decide. So if you belong to a large fund that's been set up by a bank or a union group, the people they've put in charge decide. If you belong to an SMSF, it's all the people who are left as trustees after you die that decide. So if you've got the classic two-member fund, you and a spouse, you die, it'll be your spouse that decides. Now, that doesn't mean they can go rogue and decide whatever they want. First of all, they have to comply with the law. So all the things we've talked about so far, it can only go to your estate or a limited number of people. And also, they're trustees of a trust, so they have to take that responsibility pretty seriously. They have to act in the best interests of the members of the fund's members and beneficiaries. They have to be honest, they have to be prudent, they have to do all those good things that anyone who's the trustee of a trust has to do. But often, you said this right at the beginning, I think, sometimes someone you've never met will make the decision for you. Absolutely. Often people who belong to large funds really don't like the idea of that happening at all. So they do a binding death benefit nomination in advance, telling those trustees exactly what decision to make. As long as it's all valid, the trustees don't have any choice. They have to follow it. People who belong to SMSFs sometimes do that and sometimes they don't. You would think that they would. The same issues apply. But sometimes they don't, because they know that the people who are going to be left behind making the decision are exactly the kind of exactly the people they want to make that decision. So if you think about my SMSF, for example, my husband and I, both members, were both the trustees. If I die before him, I want him to control the money and decide where it goes. He might make different decisions depending on the ages and tax status of our children at the time or his own. So there's an optimal decision to be made, and we might not know what that is until I've actually died. So I'm quite happy not having a binding death benefit nomination, as long as he's going to be around to make the decisions for me. So alternatively, though, I might say, what if we both died together? Then I might absolutely want a binding death benefit nomination that says my super goes to my estate, and there I'll handle it under my will.
Oh, it's a really good point you make. I do think it's hilarious we keep saying in advance. You make this nomination in advance. You certainly can't do it after the fact.
It's no, true. True.
No chance you can do it after the fact. That's it. I think also in your scenario, it's probably worth noting your husband knows a lot about super, right? And there'll be other people who don't have that level of skill and knowledge, and sometimes taking the more complex question out of the equation for them can simplify someone's life at a situation where, you know, particularly if you die young, it's unexpected, it's very challenging and all those sorts of things. So a person might want just to know that it's being paid to the estate and being paid out in a simple way, rather than having to deal with more complexity that they might not be as
absolutely
equipped
they,
for from an education perspective.
Yep, you're right.
So critical thing here, it sounds like your will is just not taken into account automatically. That
no.
is an assumption many people make.
Many people think, I've got a will, my will mentions my super, so the trustees will do whatever my will says. And actually, no, your will is all about things you own yourself. So your super, though, is quite different because, again, like I said before, legally you don't own it, the trustees do. So when you die, they're legally obliged to give it to your beneficiaries. They can't just keep it themselves. But your will doesn't necessarily dictate to them who gets it and who doesn't. Only a binding nomination can dictate to your trustees. So where your will does become important is if your binding death benefit nomination says to the trustees, pay my super to my estate. Once it's in the estate, then absolutely it's subject to your will.
Yeah, right. Okay, so it's such an important point. And I know I work in an organisation which has large public super funds, and we tell members all the time, if you don't want us making a decision about where your super benefits go, and I don't think large funds even enjoy doing it, right? It's actually quite difficult.
And it's quite intrusive, because they end up having to ask a lot of questions about your life before you died. Who are there potential beneficiaries out there that are not immediately obvious? So I'm imagining large funds would absolutely encourage people to do binding death benefit nominations. And to be honest, if I belonged to one, I would, because I would want to make that decision in advance about where my money goes.
Yeah, and it's if you are interested, there is a whole lot of case law. There used to be the Superannuation Complaints Tribunal. The name's changed now and I can't remember what it's called. But where people would take grievances with issues that happen within super funds. And the largest issue was always around death benefits and to whom they were paid. And the trustee would have to justify the decision they made. And it would always be these horrendous situations where it was
New spouse,
marital breakdown, kids from second marriage, kids from first marriage, all these sorts of, adult children competing with a new spouse, this kind of stuff. Exactly what you would expect it to be. People getting very hostile in many cases and very upset about feeling that they had not been treated fairly by the trustee. The trustee is just trying to follow the law. They're not personally involved. They're just trying to do what they were supposed to do. One thing you should be aware of, if you wanted to go back and look at any of that case law, they're very clear that superannuation is not there to be paid in lieu of an inheritance. And so if they have to make a decision in the absence of any other information, they will leave the benefit to a spouse, irrespective of how long they've been a spouse, and any minor children or children with a disability. So a kid under the age of 18 will take precedence over a kid over the age of 18 in that scenario. And they had to keep saying this over and over again, we're not here to provide you an inheritance if you're an adult child. If there is a spouse, this person was supposed to live with the deceased in retirement. They would have been living on these benefits with this person. It was really messy and really ugly. So you're right, trustees really love people making a binding nomination, and SMSF is really, really different. Let's think about some scenarios here. If I want to leave my super to the Flat Earth Society, for example, in that situation I'd have to get the super fund to pay it directly to my estate. Use a binding death benefit nomination to do that?
That's right. And then your will would need to say, my super should go to the Flat Earth Society. And your husband might be a little bit peeved about that.
Yes. More than a little bit. Okay, so here's one of the really big questions. So I think you've laid it out beautifully, the things that you need to think about just in terms of ensuring it gets to the right person. Trustee can only pay to a limited number of people. There is actually a hierarchy of who gets it if it comes from a public offer fund, if you have to contest it. Hopefully that is not an issue anyone listening has to deal with. You can make a binding nomination to ensure it goes to your estate or to one of those people, and you can do it in different proportions. This is something people don't necessarily know. So if I was making a binding nomination to a public offer fund, assuming they allow it, they don't all have to allow it, but assuming they do, I could make a nomination that's 50% to my husband and 25% each to my two children if I wished.
You absolutely could. That's right.
So you can be quite directive with this stuff, but let's say you've gone through that process, you know that you want it to go to certain people, or you want it paid to your estate so that someone else can make decisions about where it's going to go. But then you've got to make sure your will's on top of everything as
That's right. Yes. So the will's still vital. It just doesn't get first crack.
Yes, or it may not get any crack at all if you don't get in front of this. So once we've dealt with that, making sure it gets to the right person, here's one that gets even less attention, but goodness, it matters. Does it matter who gets my super when it comes to tax?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's a really good question, because you're right, we often spend a lot of time worrying about who's getting the money, but we then neglect how much tax they pay, because if two recipients pay totally different rates of tax, one's going to get a lot more money than the other. So there's a very small set of people that can have your super without paying any tax. Now, it's similar, but not exactly the same as the list we just talked about. There are a few differences, and for most people that difference is adult children. So when we were talking about who can have the money, then adult children are classified as a dependent for superannuation purposes. When it comes to talking about who pays tax, adult children who are financially independent are not classified as dependents for tax purposes. So while they can have the money, they will pay tax. Whereas, say, a spouse and a minor child can have it without paying any tax at all. So can a couple of other people, the interdependency thing we talked about before, people who are financially dependent on you. But for most people, once the kids grow up, it's the spouse that can have the super tax-free.
Right, okay. So can I just leave it in the fund?
Lovely
can I leave it in there and not pay tax? Is that an option?
Lovely thought, isn't it? And in fact, these days, given that it's so hard to get money in to super, wouldn't that be a great inheritance as an adult child? Mm. I'll take over Dad's super balance. That'd be fantastic. But no, look, unfortunately, death is one of the few occasions when the super fund trustees actually have to do something with the money. So they're obliged to either pay it out as a lump sum or allow somebody to take it as a pension. They can't just leave it sitting there.
Right, okay, right. So pensions we know are very attractive. They are concessionally taxed, generally speaking. Most people love the idea of getting a pension, tax-free over 60, all this kind of stuff. It's pretty cool. Who can have my super as a pension? You've mentioned it, so some people can.
Yeah, so some people can and some people can't. So for most people, it's the spouse and children under 18. Children between 18 and 25 can have a pension, but only if they were dependent on you when you died. So a university-age child who's still being supported, that would be fine, but it would have to actually stop once they get to 25. Children over 25 are only allowed to have a pension from their parents' super if they've got some serious disabilities. So that's pretty rare. For most people, again, once the children are all grown up, the person who can have their super as a pension is their spouse.
Okay, so my brother has Down syndrome, and a pension from my parents' super fund is something we've contemplated for him. Would be classified as one of the disabilities that allows you to get it, but my sister and me, there's nothing.
That's
no pension for us.
That's absolutely right. And you know, that would be true even if you were actually financially dependent on your parents for some reason. It's not about whether you depend on them. Mm. Children are treated very uniquely when it comes to the question of can they have a parent's super as a pension. And it really is all around age and whether or not you've got a disability.
Mm, and quite a severe disability as well. There's a lot of areas with disability where the definitions are quite...
Yes, yeah.
They change so much depending on which part of the law you're looking at. But
this particular definition refers you back to the Disability Services Act, which is basically, are you disabled enough to require services? So, yeah.
So what do people do usually when their spouse dies? I mean, you see this in practice quite a bit. Do people usually take the super as a pension, or do they just take it out of the fund?
Look, it varies, but mostly in SMSFs we see people take a pension from their spouse's super if they can. And the reason they do it is because it lets them leave the money in the super fund for as long as possible. Usually that's a great spot for it to be from a tax point of view. But these days, there are tax rules that limit how much any of us can put into a pension over our lifetime. So your listeners have probably heard this magic number of 1.6 million bandied about. I bet you've done some podcasts on that in the last couple of years.
Do you know what? We actually haven't.
Right. Well,
for
that's
the simple
topic.
Reason that it's a relatively small number of people. And while we all aspire to be there, it's a relatively small number. We write a bit about it, podcast.
So the trick with death, though, is... not only does your own super count when you put it into a pension against that $1.6 million limit, but so does your spouse's if you try to take theirs as a pension. So you may think at the moment, doesn't affect me, we've both got about $850,000 each, but if you inherit your spouse's and you want to take that as a pension, then you bump into that limit. So people who bump into that limit might end up taking some of their spouse's super out as a lump sum, but often if they can, they'll leave it as a pension and take it that way.
So most retirees, if they have sufficient super, will use super to start a pension. So for the reasons I mentioned, it's very, very attractive, very tax effective. Many will set up a reversionary pension, which you haven't mentioned. It means they set up their pension so that it automatically continues to pay their spouse when they die. They've been around for a long time and there's a lot of complexity to them now, it's relatively straightforward. Does that change anything here?
Well, it definitely can, actually, and it depends a lot on the rules of the fund you're in. So in SMSFs, you can decide what the rules are, and so we're tempted to think we can kind of make them up as we go along. Actually, not true, unfortunately. They're all laid out in that in the trust deed, the legal document that governs the fund. So even if you have an SMSF, you need to understand what that trust deed says, because they're the rules that will apply when you die. So to answer your question, does the reversionary pension thing change anything? Let me just give you a couple of scenarios, because it's classic superannuation speak. It depends. So what you've described, where your super, your pension continues automatically to your spouse when you die, and you've said, as you've said, that's called a reversionary pension. It's called that because it reverts to someone else when you die. Let's say the rules of your fund were that a reversionary pension trumps a binding death benefit nomination. So if the two are in conflict, which one wins? And let's say the rules of your fund said the reversionary pension wins. Well, in that case, even if you'd told the trustee, binding death benefit nomination, I want my super to go to my estate, the trustee would actually have to ignore it. And because they've got, if it's possible to have this, an even more binding legal document, which is the reversionary pension documentation, saying, no, that super is going to continue to the spouse. Someone else's fund, though, might have completely different rules. That might say, no, the binding death benefit nomination wins every time. So you set your pension up as reversionary. You think it's going to continue to your spouse, only to find that when you die, the binding death benefit nomination said something different. It said pay it to the estate, and all of a sudden it can't continue to your spouse. It's got to go to the estate because that fund had rules that said the binding death benefit nomination won. So it can be really confusing, and maybe the best advice we can give to your listeners is make sure the two say the same thing. Make them consistent so they say the same thing and there is no conflict.
I think it's worth noting as well, this is the kind of podcast that could be just peppered with horror stories. You know, the estate law in general and superannuation estate law is just full of examples where people got it wrong for one reason or another, and brothers sue sisters and parents sue kids and lots of people sue their parents, new spouse. There's a lot of stuff that happens. It's really nasty. One of the major reasons is people don't get their documentation right. You know, they're missing a signature, they didn't get it witnessed properly, it wasn't quite well drafted, all those sorts of things. So it's very tricky for people to make sure they get this right, but the documentation really does matter. In this scenario you're talking about, if I still want to ensure that my super gets to my spouse, how do I do that?
Right, so you haven't set up a reversionary pension, but you do want it to go to your spouse. You could do a couple of things. You could do a binding death benefit nomination that says, I want my super to go to my spouse. You could even say, I want it to go to my spouse as a pension, so it stays in the super fund. Alternatively, you could say, I want my super to go to my estate, and then in your will say, I'd like that to go to my spouse. Now, once you do that, though, it's come out of the super fund. The spouse doesn't have an option to take it as a pension.
So there's quite significant tax consequences for that, to be honest. You know, the difference between the tax treatment in the superannuation system and the tax treatment when it's in your own name, you know, depending on your marginal tax rate, can be really significant. So for a lot of people, keeping it in the super system is really attractive.
That's right. So it doesn't, from a tax point of view, it doesn't matter. There won't be any extra tax paid at the time you take it out. Mm. It's still ending up with the spouse, so it'll still be tax-free to the spouse when the money goes into the estate. But after that, it's all coming, it's all earning income and coming to you in a non-superannuation environment. So very different treatment going forward.
Yeah, so you're paying tax at your marginal rate. And if it's not a large amount of money, that may not be
that
material.
That may not matter.
But if
no.
It's a very large amount of money, that can be very material indeed. So most people leave their super to their spouse, but if their spouse dies first, they tend to leave it to the children. This is a common scenario. What are some of the common issues that you see?
Yes, you're right. Most people do leave their super to their spouse, but even if you do that, somebody's got to die second. So it'll ultimately end up with the children one way or another. And often, by the time they get it, because people tend to die when they're older, the children are all grown up. So one of the consequences is they can't take it as a pension, like I mentioned before. So that means the super has to be paid out of the fund. And if you think about that in an SMSF context, that might mean that all the assets get sold and the fund ends up being wound up. That's not a terrible thing, by the way. If you think about it, superannuation is all about helping people retire comfortably. So once both members of a couple have died, the super's really done its job. Both members of the couple have died, their retirement is over, it's all done. So winding the fund up under those circumstances seems kind of logical to me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that the assets have to be sold. I think this is one of the things that does make people quite anxious about a self-managed super fund. It's a quarantined environment, for want of a better term, in that you've got all of your assets held in a single structure. And then when you wind it up, as you say, it makes perfect sense in terms of it having served its purpose. But if you've got some big assets in there, that could be a bit of an issue. So if you've got property in there, particularly a family farm or something, what goes on there?
Yes, and actually I should have been clearer there. I said you need to sell the assets. That implies it needs to leave the family in some way. Actually, the money or the assets just have to leave the fund. They could be transferred into the hands of another family member. In an SMSF, for example, let's say I was the only adult beneficiary of my parents' super fund and they owned a property in it. The trustee of the SMSF could just transfer ownership of that property to me in order to pay the benefit to me. They don't have to sell it to a third party and then give me the cash. They can give me an asset instead of giving me the cash. Now, legally, it's just as if the super fund had sold the asset, but it's done so by transferring it to me.
This is going to be really interesting. Okay, so you've mentioned the two things that come into play when adult children inherit their parents' super. There's this issue of paying out assets. That's quite interesting. We've talked about the fact that children often grown up, they can't take the super as a pension. What's the other big one?
Yeah, well, the other one, we touched on it earlier and we didn't really get into any detail, but the other one's probably the bigger issue. Adult children generally pay tax when they inherit a parent's super. So whenever anyone inherits their parent's super, the payment gets split up into two bits. One bit is called the tax-free component and the other one is the taxable part. And the name's a bit of a spoiler there. Funnily enough, the taxable part potentially gets taxed and the tax-free bit doesn't. So we're talking about adult children here who do potentially pay tax on that taxable part. A spouse doesn't have to worry about these bits. Spouse doesn't pay any tax at all. And we've all got them. So if anyone wants to know how much of their own super is, how their own super is broken up into these two parts, you just have to look at the last statement you got from your super fund. It'll actually say, this is your taxable component and this is your tax-free component. So for our purposes here, though, if we're talking about an adult child inheriting a parent's super, we really care about that taxable component because an adult child will pay at least 15% on that component, and even more, actually, if under some circumstances, if the parent dies before they get to 65. And it's really easy to dismiss that as, 15% sounds like a lovely low tax rate. I wish my income was taxed at that low rate. But remember, this is a tax on capital. Now, when you think about it in that context, it's pretty nasty. So let's imagine you inherited $500,000 from a parent's super and it was all taxable component. That whole $500,000 would be subject to 15% tax, which is a $75,000 tax bill. I suspect that's probably the biggest tax bill most people would ever receive in their life, and it might take a bit of a shine off the inheritance.
Yeah, no, it's a big number when you put it like that. It's worth noting as well, the tax-free component is comprised generally of after-tax contributions you've made. For people who've just accrued super over their working lives, they may have no tax-free component.
Absolutely.
I've got no tax-free component.
Lots of people have no tax-free component.
I maybe have a tiny little bit from some co-contribution like a million years ago. Most people have no tax-free component. So, you know, that 15% or more is applying to the whole amount. The other one is, which we won't go into, but is if you get insurance benefits paid into the fund. So if you've got a large insurance, and it all gets pretty ugly. So is there anything you can do about it?
Yes, well, funnily enough, a lot of people try not to have the problem. And by that, I don't mean they try not to die, although that would probably be nice too. But what people do try and do sometimes is clear out their super before they die. So if you know you're the only one left of you and your spouse, you know you've got adult children, you know that whatever they inherit of your super is going to be taxed, you might specifically choose to take money out of your super account while you're still alive. Because you can, you know, if you're in your 80s, you can do that tax-free. So you take it out while you're still alive because you don't pay tax. You then invest it in your own name. And when your children inherit, they inherit that money that's in your own name. Now, downside, of course, is if you do it too early, you'll end up earning a lot of income on that money you've transferred out of super. You'll miss out on all the great tax benefits having that money in super gave you, so it's always a trade-off. But particularly we see people who have lost their spouse and are unwell themselves and very elderly. They'll use that as a time to start taking all their money out of super with the specific objective of saving tax for their kids.
Wow, okay, that's very forward thinking of them. What other things should people be aware of when it comes to minimising the tax liability they might be looking at?
Look, there are a couple of things people can do. The first one's small, but it's really worth remembering. If super is going to an adult child and it comes to them directly from the fund, so we've said a couple of times they're allowed to have the money, but they do pay tax. But if it comes to them directly from the fund, they pay Medicare levy on it. Now, again, small number, it's only 2%, but think back to our $500,000 inheritance we were talking about before. 2% of $500,000 is $10,000. So now our tax bill of $75,000 is up to $85,000. Simply passing it through the estate first saves that Medicare levy because estates don't pay Medicare, only people do.
Wow, that's quite cool. But it doesn't save the whole 15%.
No, sorry, Gemma. You can't get around the 15% because basically it's the tax law's really smart here. It says, I don't care whether you get the money directly from the fund or via the estate. If you're getting it and you're someone we should be hitting with tax, we'll hit you with tax. So that 15% will come regardless if the money ends up in the hands of someone who should be paying tax, but you can avoid the Medicare levy.
Worth noting as well, as I said, if you get a super benefit from an untaxed source, which is often insurance benefits, and also some people who have government super funds, they need to think about other kinds of tax rates because it's not just going to be 15% in that scenario.
That's right, yes.
It's messy. It's so complicated, but that's okay. You mentioned there were several things that could be done about the tax bill when adult children inherit their parents' super. One was the parent taking the money out in advance before they die. It's quite forward thinking. The other is making sure it goes via the estate so they don't pay Medicare levy. One more?
Yes. So actually there is one more. And that's, again, you talked about taking money out before you die being forward thinking. This is ultra forward thinking, but you'd be amazed at how often it happens. So I mentioned before, super gets broken up into a taxable component and a tax-free component. The tax-free component goes to anyone, whoever gets it, tax-free. It's only the taxable component we need to worry about. So what some people do, if they have enough time, is they take steps very deliberately to take money out of their taxable component and put it back in again. Because as you said before, money that comes in from your own wealth that you don't claim a tax deduction for lands in your tax-free component. Now, it's kind of hard to do these days because there are limits on when you can take it out and there are limits on when you can put it back in. But some people end up in this sweet spot. They've retired, but they're not yet 65. So they might be in a spot where they're allowed to take the money out, but they're also allowed to put it back in again. So they do exactly that, and that tends to reduce their taxable component and increase their tax-free component. So let's take our $500,000 person before and imagine they were 62, completely retired, and they hadn't made any of their own personal contributions ever before. They could just take $300,000 out and put $300,000 back in. And that basically saves them the 15% tax on that $300,000, or saves their children, I should say, 15% tax on that $300,000.
You'd like to have a parent like that, wouldn't you? Who's really thinking ahead to make sure that you're not paying any additional amounts you don't absolutely need to pay. So how would you suggest this? Is, you know, it's such a complex topic, and it's hard for people to understand. And also, people hate thinking about it in the first place, let alone thinking about it sifting through the complexity, understanding the things that are likely to apply to them, and then taking the next step. How do you suggest people go about preparing for this? Because as I mentioned, documentation is absolutely imperative. A lot of people have done the work but didn't get the documentation done correctly, and that still caused them a lot of pain. Would you suggest that people just, you know, if you're in a public offer fund, you go to the fund's website, download the forms and maybe some helpful guides? Should you talk to a professional? What would you suggest at this point?
Look, I'm a big advocate for advice here. To be honest, I think you said right at the beginning, we've had compulsory super for a long time. It's often people's second biggest asset. For young people, it's their biggest asset. It seems crazy to me that we get advice on wills that look after our other assets, and we wouldn't extend that to get advice on what to do with our super, if only to make sure it's consistent with our will. So whilst, yes, you can absolutely download forms from a big fund's website and you can fill them in and that will be legally binding, to be honest, I don't think I would do it without some advice, even if you think your affairs are quite simple.
It's amazing how many people who think their affairs are simple.
Good point.
It can
yes.
be astonishingly complex when it comes to estate planning. We've certainly seen many of them over the years, and it used to be one of the most extraordinary parts of my job reading the cases from the Superannuation Complaints Tribunal and just going, goodness me. It's a young guy, this is many years ago, maybe 20 years ago, a young guy who died at 25, and he had a de facto partner and a daughter. The de facto partner, he left $50,000 in a super, which wasn't an insignificant amount of money, but it wasn't going to change anybody's life, and died in a workplace accident, which was fairly dreadful. And 9 different people made a claim on his super.
Wow.
Made a claim that they were all financial dependents. His mother, several of his brothers and sisters, a whole lot of people in his life were making claims that they were financially dependent on this guy, and he was earning about 50 grand a year. It was quite an astonishing case to read. Like, his situation would have looked pretty straightforward from the outside, but there were plenty of people who were willing to argue it wasn't.
Yeah, and you'd absolutely want somebody in that situation to have, I know we say, oh, it's only 50,000, but crikey, it was probably a lot of money for the de facto and the child.
Oh, I think the child was 2.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a 2-year-old child, that is the difference between, you know, living in penury and being able to survive for a little while, at least till the child goes to school. So the tribunal, if anyone cares, the tribunal found in favour of the de facto spouse and the daughter and said everyone else can get lost. They were clearly not dependents. He had a family and he needed to look after them. But it was amazing how many other people felt that they had a claim.
How many people came out of the woodwork?
Yeah, incredible. Meg, you are so generous with your insights about SMSFs. You work really hard to ensure that people understand how they work. You put lots of really cool stuff out there. And you also work really hard at an industry level, you know, keeping everybody honest and making sure things function well. How do people keep up to date with you guys and what you're up to?
You just made me out to be a real nerd, Jenna. So I'll park that. You'll pay for it later. But I love this kind of thing, to be honest. And probably the best place to go for anything else of interest would be our website, www.hefron.com.au. For trustees, we've actually got a really good publication that goes out quarterly now called Life is Super, which explores things like this, for trustees who might be interested in learning more.
Fantastic. Meg, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it's been helpful in your journey to creating wealth, or in this case, keeping wealth for your kids. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.